7 years to deliver it, and I only ever saw that being the halfway point. The real challenge, of course, going forward, is how do we capture everything that we witnessed over the summer of last year and leave a sustainable and lasting change for the next 10 years. The next 10 years of the journey, for me, is probably as every bit as exciting as the first 10 years. And how do I define that? I think we can break that down into 4 or 5 really key meaty areas. Of course, we want more young people playing sport. And in the United Kingdom, since we won the right to stay in games in 2005, we now have 1.5 million more people playing sport than a good chunk of them, young people. In the first year since the delivery of the games, the British economy has benefited to the tune of about £10 billion. And that's been identified by those organisations that have either made investment decisions in the UK based on the back, off the back of the games that they were involved in, or those companies that have actually grabbed a greater space in that niche market around event management and construction, particularly in the sustainable area. There is, of course, the other very key one, the spiritual value of the games, and I talked about our games makers and volunteers. Well, I'm delighted to be able to report that in the first year since the games, there's been a 6% increase in volunteering. And interestingly, although some of you might challenge whether there is a correlation or causality there, there's been quite a dramatic increase in philanthropic giving since the games. One of the overlooked legacies, of course, is the Paralympic Games. I wish I had a little bit more time to talk about those this morning. They have had a profound impact on the United Kingdom. Nielsen, our research partners, have shown that 75% of the nation now sees disability in a very different light. And the Prime Minister spoke at the conference, the Conservative Party conference, just after the Games, talking about how the Games had allowed people to look beyond the wheelchair and not a disability but ability. I think we have actually struck a very important chord. Challenging misconceptions about disability is one of the key challenges, one of the key legacies we saw in the Paralympic Games. Taking a Paralympian into a classroom, as I often did in the lead up to the Games, and having them explain to young people, nominally able-bodied, sitting there, that they, with one leg, can jump above the height of the door frame in the classroom, actually opened the eyes to people, and I think collectively as a nation opened the eyes to people that actually Paralympians were doing what 99% of the able-bodied population wouldn't be able to get within a country mile of. And the final legacy, which I'm probably as proud about as anything, is the challenge we set ourselves to transform the landscape of East London. If you've got on a tube train in Westminster, the heart of London, you wouldn't have 9 stops between Westminster and Stratford International Railway Station, that parcel of land that we have developed. If you get off at any one of those stops, you lose 1 year in life expectancy. Newham, at the heart of the Olympic Park, had an unemployment rate in pockets of 42%. Figures that are challenged across London and across the UK. But in any indices of assessment, Newham, probably the most deprived part of the United Kingdom. And yet, within 7 years, we now have 8 permanent venues. We have the largest retail shopping development in Europe, having created 10,000 jobs with another 4 to go. An Olympic Village, where residents have been moving in literally over the last few weeks, and as we talk, a new set of schools and hospitals. And most appropriately, we have sports venues that will go on driving sustainable living long after people have forgotten about the London Games. So the big challenge going forward is to, yes, remind ourselves and bathe warmly in the fun and the experiences of last year, but to go on driving the real and lasting tangible benefits of the Games in the way that Barcelona did with its infrastructural changes around the port area, in the way that Sydney did in its alignment and its public perception about where that nation was going to, in the way that Beijing did, in the way that all cities do. But I do think in London we probably have a better chance than most cities in driving that legacy across a number of multiple and interdisciplinary areas that will make a significant change to the way that we view ourselves in the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom is viewed around the world. That is about as quick in 20 minutes a romp across the landscape as I can possibly give you. And I now look forward to being cross-examined, as I was by Stephen. Stephen Sacker interviewed me. It's the first interview I gave once I'd come back from Singapore, and it was a pretty hard-hitting interview, I seem to remember, Stephen. So I'm going to put my tin helmet on there.
If you take a seat there, sir, and I will get my stool over here, and you put your tin hat on, and off we go. There's so much that's interesting about what happened with the London Beard, and then I want to look forward to the future, but let's go back to the London Beard. And I'm very aware that in this room there are lots of people running businesses, involved in businesses, for whom the competitive tendering process is very much a part of what they do. And in a way, bidding for the Olympics is perhaps the most high-profile global competitive tendering business you can ever imagine. So if you boil it all down, what do you believe the key was to London coming from Berlin, overtaking Paris, and that's basically what people in this audience will be interested in, that sort of confrontation between London and Paris. London, in the end, overtook Paris and won the great prize. So in that whole competitive process, what would you say was the key to your victory?
I think it's very easy to talk about vision, and it's an often derided word and can mean a slew of different images. But I think the vision that we created in London about using the power of the Games to connect young people to sport was a very simple and clear one. I think within that vision, we were prepared to challenge some orthodoxies. And you know, this is a conference about brands, really. If we're being honest, and I looked at the scene, the landscape, the average age of people watching the Olympic Games between 1994 and 2004 rose from 36 to nearly 50. Now, that by any stretch of the imagination is not a sustainable brand. It isn't sustainable for broadcasters, it's certainly not sustainable for those partners that came to the table who were looking for, you know, younger demographics. And I think we posed some challenges, without lecturing or being hectoring about it, we posed some challenges and said, look, when you look around at the other cities and you look at London, who do you think is best placed to actually steer the movement into the space that you need to be with younger people? We did some interesting research, again, really for our own guidance, less for comparison. But of the five cities that we're building, we asked a very simple question to people between the ages of 18 and 24. And it was a simple question. If you do not stay in your own country, i.e. Paris, New York, Madrid, Moscow, if you do not stay in your own country, your own city, to study or to take your first foot on a career path, where would you go? And 90% said London. New York, tucked in behind, but you know, these were very small. So we realized that it was not so much about creating something that didn't have a, you know, it was just a synthetic construct, but actually London had some really deep-seated values. It was creative, it was modern, it was competent. You know, we needed to proud of our history, protective, but also welcoming. And I think somewhere in that space, we just consistently drove that message.
The other thing about the Olympic bidding process is that obviously it's run by the IOC, the Olympic, International Olympic Committee, which is a pretty strange organization, I think you'd agree. I just wonder to what
extent. Not as strange as people think, actually.
Isn't it?
No, it's actually. It's a lot more straightforward. It's shrouded in myth and.
It's also shrouded in allegations of scholarly.
Well, if you go back to 1997, 98, there's been a dramatic sea change.
I mean, I think there are one or two French people who think that London and scholarly went together a little bit in the run up to a writer. Before we get to that point, I was actually thinking of a bigger question, which is to what extent do you have to play the game? And this brings me to the point about the stardust element that you brought to the London bid. You know, we deployed our most ferocious weaponry, thinking of Prince William, David Beckham, and Tony Blair, or you can argue Tony Blair is a bit of a mixed blessing these days, but you know, all of these immensely sort of powerful and arguably attractive characters were sprinkling stardust over our bid. And does that matter very much? Is that important?
Of course it is, and why wouldn't you do that? You know, if these are big brand ambassadors for your country, why not do them? And let me be really clear, I mean, Tony Blair played an absolutely integral part of this. When I first was asked to, he asked me whether I would take a bid on, and I said, I needed to ask simply one question, and I worked as chief of staff and leader of the opposition, so I knew, I knew what his diary was. And I said, I'm never going to cry wolf, I know how busy you are, but there will be moments when I really need your help. And he could not be more accommodating. And in fact, in the last, you know, we talked about the roles that heads of state and political leaders play. I mean, Tony Blair sat down with 30, I'd identified before the vote, 34 swing voters. The 34 within the 104 whose decision would determine whether the games were going to come. He sat with every one of those 34 for 15 minutes over the space of a day and a half. And if anybody was put on this planet to do something well, it was Tony Blair sitting there. It was the most interesting insight. He never asked for anybody's vote. Conversations were wide ranging. They could be, you know, somebody would sit there and from, you know, Puerto Rico and ask about some of the biggest challenges that he was facing in forming public sector unions. Rarely was it a discussion about the games, but it was the opportunity to sit down with the British Prime Minister and talk about that. And I think that made a big impact.
Well, surely you can't be suggesting that Tony Blair was a greater asset than George W. Bush or Jack Chirac, and very hard. Wouldn't be hard to believe at all. I mean, I suppose that's the point in a way. You
have to be able to know how to do that, because Obama, of course, came to Copenhagen and Chicago went out in the first round.
That's true.
So it doesn't always follow. I mean, Putin went to Guatemala and Sochi won. So it's not an exact science. And in fact, the president of Prime Minister of Turkey and the Crown Prince in Spain were both bidding and both presented in Buenos Aires just a few weeks ago. It isn't an exact science. You do need to know how and when to play that. And actually, the mistake that is often made is only bringing these big leagues towards the end.
That's a very inevitable triplet.
Tony Blair was on that project for 3 years. It was hardly an IOC member that visited London that wasn't invited in that industry.
One final quick point, looking back, and then I want to look forward. But,
yeah.
But you actually had to put these games together in that sort of 5 year period in the run up to 2012, when the world economy was in terrible mess, and the British economy in particular was really struggling. You know, we went through years of recession. I just wonder how important it was to have brought both the political class and the public on board for the project when you were spending really significant amounts of money at a time when the nation really could barely afford it, at least felt it could barely afford it.
Yes, I think there are two things. My political hero is Abraham Lincoln, and I'm always guided by probably one of the, as a politician, I mean, Lincoln was the consummate politician. People tend to forget he was probably the consummate politician. And his very simple observation that with public sentiment nothing can fail, but without it nothing will succeed, is one that in a campaign is always worth holding on to. And that's the problem at the moment within Europe, that politicians are running ahead of public opinion by quite some degree. So making sure that the public were always on board, and the thing that bids and organising committees tend to forget is that you want them to feel ownership. Because with ownership comes delivery, and with delivery actually comes inclusion, and you have to create opportunities for people to feel that they have a role, they have a proprietorial interest in that. And actually, of course, a year out, when you guys are getting tired of listening to the chair and telling you everything is okay, you actually take a step sideways and you allow local communities and people that the games are really impacting on to tell the story for you. So I was absolutely determined to make sure that we had complete political unanimity, so that when the evaluation team came to London, they met Tony Blair, but they also met Michael Howard, who was then the leader of the Conservative Party, Charles Kennan, the Liberal Democrats. They met the political leadership. And I think the public were comforted that the games never became a political football. We had two general elections, two mayoral elections, complete change of direction in Scotland, and two-thirds political change in our local authorities. And yet, every political party at both elections saying using exactly the same wording in their manifesto. And I think that drove a level of confidence amongst the public. But giving the public opportunity to be part of the games, either in volunteering or in torch relays, or in actually shaping the direction of the games in their local communities was key, I think.
Right, let's make a little personal now. Which gave you a bigger buzz, more of an adrenaline kick? Winning those gold medals, as you did, as an individual performer, and goodness knows, being a middle distance runner, it is a lonely and a hugely individualistic spiral, you see, you have coaches coming up. In the end, it's all about you as an individual on the track. So that was a moment of immense triumph for you. And then you had that extraordinary period culminating in summer 2012, where you were the guy who was seen as the driving force, the architect of a very successful Olympic Games, which, in the end, looking back, has given you the bigger buzz.
The only way I can answer that question is probably just for a few moments. It's not a long story. Just talk about an event that took place the day before the vote at lunchtime. I invited the athletes, those that really understood the project and I felt could articulate it in Singapore, to come up. So in other words, I've got David Thompson, Jonathan Edwards, Annie Greg Thompson, our great Paralympian, Adia Dapatan, who's our wheelchair basketball player that presented for Channel 4 during the games, and Colin Jackson. In that room at lunchtime, before the vote in the nurse centre, we had a sort of make-do lunch. And I can't remember who raised the subject, but we got into that debt of really, do you think it's going to be all right tomorrow? And I remember I was sort of still number crunching, they looked naturally away. And I said, I can't remember who raised the subject, but we all, at the end of that lunch, agreed that we would swap anything we'd done individually in our sports. And there were a lot of medals in that room, and Tony Craig Thompson had most of them. I have to say, it took Bailey Thompson slightly longer to enter that model,
maybe.
If he was sitting here now, he would still deny it or agree to it. But we basically, I think, came to the conclusion that, yes, we'd like to think that we've done enough to put a few more people in our sport and excite a few more people, and Bailey and Tanny certainly did in very different ways. But I think we had all intellectually concluded that there was nothing that we'd done individually that could be potentially greater than anything that we could do over the 7 years of delivery, the culmination of something that really could change our lives, and the next 10 years of grabbing everything that we witnessed last year. So if you said to me, would I hand them over, would I hand those medals over in exchange for the last 7 years? Absolutely, every minute of it, I think, is collectively. You know, do you think the spirit of generosity across millions and millions of people? I don't think I would ever witness another event in my lifetime that brought the nation together in the way that it did, and I think that had to be greater than anything individually, anybody done in the sport up to that point.
Powerful words. And a final thought then. You have a transition process where you can know what experience and insight you can for Rio.
Yes.
And interestingly, I know now you've just got a sort of formal position advising Tokyo, looking much further ahead to the Tokyo Olympics as well. You know, we talk about London being a watershed Olympics, certainly in terms of what it did for Britain, and it was a spectacular success. Do you believe the Olympics can get better and better? Are you very confident Rio will be a great Olympics, and looking further ahead to Tokyo? And to what extent do you feel that there is an important legacy of handing on every 4 years, handing on what has been learned from the last one to the next one? Does that really make a difference?
It does make a difference. It makes a huge difference. The transfer of knowledge, which is what the IOC now call it, is a relatively new concept. You know, if you go back even to sort of 92 in Barcelona and then Atlanta in 96 and Sydney in 2000, there were, you know, these were games that were effectively created in isolation. Yes, of course, the International Olympic Committee had their coordination teams, but those teams would meet a couple of times a year, and you know, they'd fly, and it could be very much at a helicopter level. We now have a much more formalized structure where, for instance, after the Rio Games, we spend a month sitting in camera with all the Rio teams talking very openly about things that went well, the things that we felt we could, in hindsight, have done differently, whether it was around transportation, security, accreditation, all the thousands of moving parts that make up the games. And the only thing I would point out is that it's not really about whether a games is better. It's about whether they're different. They are inevitably different. It would have been a cataclysmic error for me to have sat at the end of the Beijing Games and concluded that actually I needed to deliver a Beijing Games in London. I mean, A, it would have been impossible. B, we'd never have had the budget. And thirdly, I don't think people would have been expecting that. And so Sydney was very different from Barcelona. Barcelona was very different from Atlanta. London will be, and will be very, very different from Rio. And Rio will be an extraordinary Games in a very unique setting. And Tokyo, again, will be different. And you know, often we end up with this sort of idea, well, wouldn't it be much better to just leave the Games in the same city and the same home? Actually, no. The great impact that the Games has in that global journey, inspiring and using enough of the project management to make sure that the people you really don't want to shortchange are the athletes they are, and that's why you deliver it for. But at the same time, having that great opportunity is real. The Games have never been to South America, never been, honestly, to Brazil. The ability to impact on 280 million South Americans over that period is extraordinary. And I think it's a good thing that the knowledge transfer sits alongside the ability to really globalize sport.
Well, Seb, thank you so much for that. You've given us some incredible memories that I think will live, certainly with me, but I think for many people, live long in the memory, probably last a lifetime, and there's clearly still a great deal to look forward to. So thank you very much for joining us at the TFA. Thank you to Sebastian. Now, ladies and gentlemen, our next special guest speaker has had quite a build-up already, because as Eric said in his introductory remarks, I think everybody in this room knows that your industry, your collective businesses, could not exist in the form they do without the airline business. The airline industry. And as our next speaker, we have one of the most important global players in that industry. He is currently the CEO, the boss of a conglomerate known as IAG, the International Airline Group. It is made up of British Airways and Iberia, who came together in 2011 to form IAG. He began his life, and it's quite reassuring to know this, I think, for somebody who's running an airline business, he began his life as a pilot. And I suspect that quite a few of the guys who run airlines wouldn't have the first clue how to fly a plane, but that's not true of our guest today. He started out life in Ireland flying planes for Aer Lingus. He was rather good at it, but he was also good at figuring out how to run the business and indeed change that business. So he became the boss at Aer Lingus, restructured it, and became known as something of a restructuring expert within the airline business. He's now doing the same to IAG. What he does and the business he runs matters a great deal to all of you. So please give a very warm welcome to Willie Walsh, the boss of IAG.